history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you, and they have some stories to tell. Sometimes all it takes is for somebody to ask a few questions and take the time to listen. And that's exactly what we try to do here each week. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a lot. We're educated. We're entertained. Often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I've had quite a few people tell me over the years, you got to catch up with Turk Eliadis. He enjoyed a Hall of Fame career as a football coach at North High School in Bakersfield, California. But first, he had to survive some close calls in World War II as a fighter pilot and eventually a prisoner of war. His given name is Jordan, and we're going to hear where the nickname came from. But first, Turk, tell me about your hometown, where you grew up, McGill, Nevada. How big a place is that?
We probably had maybe 10,000 people. We had three towns. The high school was in Ely. That was the hub. The copper ore was mined in Ruth. It was shipped to McGill, and there it was refined into copper bars. If you look on a map where Ely is, we're 300 miles away from Las Vegas. We're 300 miles away from Reno. In other words, we're well east of town, east of the state. Growing up there, there weren't many things to do, but I knew one thing. Sports was very important with us. All three towns, from McGill and Ruth, we all were centered at Ely, and we were very proud of our program there.
How did your family end up way out there?
My dad and mom came to this country, and they stopped in New Jersey, and there was a brother there at the time, but there was no work there, so then he decided to come to Nevada. He had some relatives there also, and he worked for Kennecott Copper in all those years. We had a situation in 1943. My dad got killed in a mining accident there in McGill. That had to be in the latter part of November 1943. On the 2nd of January 1944, I was called into the service. This left my mother with two sisters and two brothers, and she went to work for the company. Mom wasn't, she could speak the language, that was not a problem. But when it came to reading and writing, she was illiterate in that respect. And her job was cleaning the offices at night, washing dishes at the boarding house, and eventually she retired. I'm going to tell you something that to me is amazing. When you talk about all the businesses now and they have difficulty, a lot of them don't want to give health benefits because it's so expensive. But my mother refused to go to a senior center, but she was getting to the point. I told her, if you don't go, we can't get somebody in McGill that will stay with you for 24 hours. You have to go to a senior center. So she did. And I did know at the time when she began to fail, they were giving her blood transfusions. And I always wrote for the whatever bills we had, I was the one that wrote checks and took care of that. Come to find out, when I really found out about this, it's amazing to me. When my mother retired, Kennecott Copper gave my mother health benefits for the rest of her life. You know, that's going back a long ways. And that's a big item today. These small businesses, they don't want to give health benefits because it's expensive.
Well, you mentioned that your parents came to this country and they came from Greece. Is that right?
They came from Greece. I have a nickname of Turk. I better explain that because there's a lot of people think my name is Turk Eliadis. If anyone came to my house and asked for Turk, my mother would be infuriated. But the thing that is crazy about it, my mother and dad were born in Turkey, a part of Turkey where basically all the people living there were Greek people. And then eventually they came to Greece itself and so on. And when they finally eventually came to this country, you know, by boat and so on, met relatives there at, like I say, in New Jersey. I had one brother out here that worked for Kennecott Copper. That's why my dad came to McGill. And then, of course, he worked there his whole life.
And so you mentioned the nickname. Now, this is from your childhood. They started calling you Turk at a pretty young age?
We were having a little deal in the backyard. Oh, just, horsing around with a bunch of kids, And most of the kids were Greek kids. They could speak the language. I could speak the language. That's not a problem. And at one time, I feel kind of embarrassed. I used to be able to write and read and everything, but I have been away from that for so long, it's very difficult to me. But while we were playing, my parents were talking Turkish up as they're overlooking this. And one of the kids says, "What are they talking?" Because they knew Greek. "They're talking Turkish." Well, that took care of that. Everyone in that town of McGill, everyone had a nickname. I have a sheet back there where all these guys that I knew from high school, everyone had a nickname. It's the way it was. I look back on that now that I'm coming to the end of the road, basically. I am glad that I grew up in a small town.
So here you are, son of Greek immigrants living in McGill, Nevada, the oldest of seven kids. Everybody's got a nickname, we know that, but what did you do as a kid? What were the things that you spent your time on?
The biggest thing, sports, baseball, mm-hmm. in summer, and fishing and hunting. We loved to go fishing. We loved to hunt, and those were main things when I grew up. There was a lot of competition among the towns. When I was in grade school, we played football. We didn't play on a grass field. We played on a dirt field. It wasn't until I went to high school that I started playing on a grass field, and so on.
Did that make you tougher?
Well, I don't know whether it did or not.
Did you have an idea at that young age, hey, when I grow up, I want to do XYZ?
I'm not sure. I know that the first year that I was at University of Nevada and I went back to grade school, I remember the principal asking me, "Well, what do you plan to do?" And I told him, "I want to teach and I want to coach." And of course, when I said coach, they couldn't understand that. They had no idea. But I had a history teacher, Ben Church, nicest guy in the world, called me aside and we talk about things like that and so on. And I told him, I look back on how I ever got to North High School. So many things happened to me along the way, and I've often wondered how I landed here at North. When you were playing at White Pine High School, and we played football, the nearest town was 125 miles away. That was our first game. We played teams from Utah. We played teams from Salt Lake City. We had teams from Salt Lake City that came to Ely and played us on a home-and-home basis. And we played other Utah schools. There were just no schools in our immediate vicinity. The big game for us was Las Vegas. When we played Las Vegas, that was the biggest game of the year. We played Sparks, which is adjacent to Reno, and we played them. Then we played Fallon. Sparks was 300 miles away. Fallon was probably around 275 miles away. So we did a lot of traveling. We were playing a game in Salt Lake City. After the game, Coach Bledsoe, and he's the reason why I'm here, he was talking to this man. The guy came over, and he was the head coach at the University of Utah. And he asked me if I would be interested in playing for them. And I said, yeah, anyone's never asked me to go play at a college and so on. But it wasn't maybe a week or two after that, the coach from the University of Nevada met me at the high school and wanted me to come and play at the University of Nevada. It wasn't hard for me to make a decision because I had so many friends that were in Reno, so I ended up playing. When we were playing, I don't remember what game it was. It was near the end of our schedule at university. We had the situation where the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. A number of guys in the fraternity house, they went in the service right away. Some of the older guys, I don't know why. But anyway, when we declared war on Germany, I knew I was going to have to go. We had our next to the last football game, and after the football game, there was a couple of other guys, and we went to Sacramento to enroll. I thought flying sounded pretty good, so that's where we signed up.
Had you ever flown before?
No, never flown before. It was all new. We took a test. I think there were four of us. Two of them didn't make it on the exam. The next day we went and had a physical. I have never had a physical like that before. What they ask you to do and some of the things, which was a normal physical check, you know, all that. And one of the guys flunked out. I was the only guy that made it. When I went back, he said to me, well, you're in school. Don't worry about it. They're not going to call you for a long time or whatever. Anyway, it was in latter part of November when my dad got killed. And I was in school at the university, got home. Of course, I was very close with my high school coach. You know, I was the quarterback on the high school football team. But I never carried the ball. Occasionally, I would receive a pass. You were a blocking back. That's what you were on, that single wing is what you were. But when I got to University of Nevada, I want to tell you, I remember the first day we were dressing and Marion Motley was there. Oh, my gosh. I can't explain to you what a body. My God, he had to be 6 foot, but man, he was just like poured out that way. I want to tell you something. You'll think it's crazy. When our fullback, who was our blocking back, they had to do the blocking. You know who had to do the blocking? I had the block for those people. We played an Army team here in town. I mean, there. And one of the guys I recognized, the name, because in the fraternity, it shows me tackling him. Of course, I didn't know who he was. When I got back here in Bakersfield, he was the head coach at Garces High School.
How about that?
Come to find out, the head coach of the junior college football team actually played in that game, but I didn't know that at the time. I remember we talked about it and so on. Because all they could talk about was Marion Motley and so on.
Well, and maybe some younger listeners don't know the name Marion Motley, but this is a Pro Football Hall of Famer, one of the greatest athletes of the 1940s. And here he is, your teammate at the University of Nevada. And you were blocking for him?
Yeah. When we played the Army team, I blocked for him that day. I remember the first time I went out to block that in, he must have hit me and knocked me after that. You know, most of those guys were all college guys that were in the service. They had some top-notch people.
Yeah, some of the air base teams and different service teams were among the greatest college football teams ever. Paul Brown had a team at Great Lakes in Chicago,
right?
Was legendary. And there were guys who'd been All-Americans who now are all on the same team playing for the service. So that's what you did while you continued at the University of Nevada until you got called to active duty. You kept playing. You told me about Pearl Harbor happening, and I know you've told this story a lot of times, but I imagine at the time, you're 18 years old, you're playing college football, you're chasing these dreams, and all of a sudden, the world changes in a day. Was that a shock to the system at the time?
Yeah, it was. I think the thing that irritates, and I can tell you a few stories about what happened there at McGill. It was important that you know this. They had two people from the Japanese government in Washington, D.C., at that time, and they were supposedly going to have a no-war agreement or something on that matter.
Right.
In the meantime, they were bombing Pearl Harbor. When the Japanese people realized why the Americans hated the Japanese so much, it was because it was unheard of. You're in there talking, we're going to get, peace and so on. In the meantime, you're bombing Pearl Harbor. I didn't understand a lot of this when I was inducted. They sent me to Tucson, Arizona. That's where we learned to fly. I came to Bakersfield, California at Minter Field. That was basic training. I learned more here about flying than any of the other two. When you came to Minter Field, I remember. I mean, he took me up and put us in a spin. Now, can you imagine? Holy mackerel, he's taking it up. You have to go like this. You got to stall your airplane. You go up, it stalls, and now the airplane's in a spin. And then it's spinning, whether it's right or left, it doesn't make any difference. If you want to stop the spin, you hit the opposite rudder for a half a spin, and then you move your stick forward, which controls the ailerons, and you come out of the spin, and it wasn't really much of a problem. But the thing that made the most important impression to me, each instructor had five people working with here at Minter Field. But I will never forget, because it happened to me, when we were on the way home one day, I was with the instructor, and all of a sudden, he turns off the gas. I'm flying, and he turned off the gas. He says, forced landing. Well, you know, you can imagine how I felt when he said forced landing. Anyway, I looked around as all I could see was vineyards down there. I don't know where I'm going to land. He did something there for me that I did later on when I was flying out of England. We were on a mission one time to southern Germany, and for some reason my plane wasn't operating properly, and there was a little bit of smoke starting to come out, and I knew that something haywire. The leader of the squadron, he says, is that plane on fire over there? And they were talking about my plane.
And you're hearing this over the radio?
Oh, yeah. And the guy says, you better abort and go back. Something happened maybe a week or so prior to all of this. We were on our way back from a mission, and we were in flights of four. We were in friendly territory. Once we got into France, we were normally in Allied territory. It wasn't a problem. All of a sudden, one of the guy's engines quit on him, and I could see him hitting the starter, trying to get that propeller to re-engage, and it didn't. We had four channels, and if you hit channel four, that's air, sea rescue. And while you're talking to them, they get a bearing immediately. He started circling, and what we did, we circled him and circled him and circled him until he got down to, I don't remember what the altitude was, but he bailed out. We went right down on the water, you know, and he waved at us and everything else. The day that I had that problem with the plane, I said to myself, there is no way I'm going to go across that channel with a bad engine. So what I did, I would fly along the coast. The cliffs of Dover, when you're flying along the channel there, it's a big white wall at that altitude. I was flying around 20,000 feet. I felt that if I had a problem, I could probably glide all the way to England. And then about that time, when I was working back and forth, deciding where to go, the darn thing quit on me. It happened to be that I had worked south of England, and I actually was in France when the plane quit on me. And I remember calling back, and I was Tudor 5-2. I called, and the guy says, bail out. I says, I'm not going to bail out. I'm going to take it down. You know, I couldn't believe that guy telling me I'm going to bail out at 20,000 feet. That's crazy. Anyway, I was lucky. It happened to be that I could see the smoke on the ground, so I knew which way I'd have to come in and land. And what happened was I just kept losing altitude, kept circling and circling and circling. I did something in an airplane that I only did one time in my life, and that was the day that I did it. Everything seemed level out there, but when I got down close, I came over a ravine, which was, oh, I don't know how deep it was. And I said, I have to get down right away because I had picked this field up ahead and I thought everything was level at the time. I cross-controlled. If you cross-control in an airplane, which means you have, let's say, left rudder, right aileron, or vice versa, your plane just drops like a rock. And it fell right away. Finally, I got out of it. You know, I picked up speed when I dropped. And I had the flaps down as far as they would go to slow me down. And I leveled off. And I just leveled off and kept my nose up slightly. And just kept going, kept going, kept going. Bang. I hit the ground. You have straps on you. There was a little bit of a tug, but it wasn't. The field that I landed in was being prepared for spring planting.
It was all plowed already?
It was all plowed. Basically, yeah. It was all plowed. And I remember, here comes all the people, and no one could speak English. So I pulled out my map, and I gave it to them, and they said, you're near Lillebonne, France, the southern part of France.
And before you put it down, did you know that it was going to be friendly territory, or were you not
sure?
Oh,
yeah. I knew I was in France because I was flying along the ocean. I was flying, trying to find the cliffs of Dover. And it was overcast. That's what bothered me. I kept flying back and forth, and I hoped that I could see the cliffs of Dover, and I couldn't. And just about the time that I was ready to turn around and go back, that's when the plane quit on me, and the guy told me to bail out. The moment that guy told me to bail out, and I said to him, I'm not going to bail out, I remembered specifically my instructor at Minter Field. He taught me more about flying than any of the other two. When I got to advance, we got in AT-6s. We did a lot of formation flying, but we didn't do any of the things that I did here at Minter Field. And I guess when you come right down to it, the experience that I learned with him, I think probably might have saved my life. I don't know.
And we're going to hear some other things that may have saved your life, but it's time right now for our first break. Turk mentioned Minter Field, and that air base in Shafter, California is long gone, but a museum remains in one of the original buildings. Go take a look if you ever find yourself in Kern County. Go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos of Turk Eliadis, and we'll be right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country, and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 93-year-old Turk Eliadis of Bakersfield, California. We were talking about his college football career at the University of Nevada, where he played with the legendary fullback Marion Motley. At some point, I mentioned Paul Brown's team at Great Lakes Naval Air Station during the war, and I forgot that Marion Motley actually ended up playing for that team after Nevada. In fact, Motley was supposed to be discharged right before those Blue Jackets played Notre Dame in 1945, but he decided to stay in uniform long enough to help pound the Irish 39-7. He reunited with Coach Brown with the Cleveland Browns as one of the first African-American players in pro football, and in 1968, Motley was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Turk Eliadis is part of a couple Halls of Fame, but on November 20th, 1944, he wasn't sure he was ever going to see his 22nd birthday. That's the day his P-51 Mustang was shot down over Holland.
The day that we flew, our leader was not a regular colonel that flew with us every day. It was a person, he worked in the office and so on, but he had to fly a certain number of hours to get his flight paid. And he was the one that was leading that day. We were told, when that young man in my barracks went down, that if we went down in the English Channel, we probably couldn't live more than 5 or 10 or 15 minutes because the water was so cold. They told us the temperatures were in places in the high 30s, low 40s. So what happened to him, I'm sure he died of exposure because we thought everything was okay. He waved at us and we got back, found out that he was passed away. I don't know. You think about all those times and so on. I remember the first mission I was into Germany. I was only 21 years old. And I remember once we got into German territory, I remember saying to myself, there's no friends down there.
And what were your typical missions like? Are you guys flying low and strafing?
There's a place called the Zuider Zee. Mm-hmm. And we would meet the bombers basically at that point. How do you know which group you're, let's say, covering and not mix it up with some other? If you look on a B-17 and you look at the tail will tell you the group. It might be a square, it might be a diamond, it might be a letter, it might be something. The letters for a 55th fighter group was Y something. If you saw a 51 that had the number Y something, it was from the 55th fighter group. Every group had a letter designation.
So most of your missions were escort missions for the bombers.
Oh, yeah, Practically everything. But we did a lot of strafing. Once we got the bombers back to friendly territory, depending on our leader, we went back and started strafing fields. We did a lot of strafing. You strafe an airfield, but the way we strafed it, we'd make a pass and then get the hell out of there. You know what I mean? A
couple things I want to rewind on and ask you about. You mentioned earlier of your father dying in the mining accident. You're already in the service at this point?
No.
You're at college still?
I was still in college.
And how devastating was that?
Oh, you just couldn't believe it. I was the oldest in the family. When I got there, to lose your dad and all the time that I spent with him, he used to prospect an awful lot. My dad actually worked a gold mine, a regular gold mine. I remember I was maybe sixth or seventh grade. I used to go, and there were two or three, I think there were three other Greek people that worked with my dad. I used to go with him when we used to prospect. I remember going all through all those mountains and so on, prospecting to see if there was a good place where they might find gold. Well, we finally, he started working a mine that had been worked, and he had checked it, and he found that there was a lot of gold material in there. Lo and behold, they start working that thing, and the first shipment he made was 3 tons, and they got over $1,000 for the 3 tons. Can you imagine? Gold was only $32 an ounce, but those tons used to run anywhere from 3 to 5 ounces a ton. Could you imagine having a mine now with the price of gold where you had 3 to 5 ounces of gold per ton? I mean, you'd be something. But, you know, I remember when he got the first check, man, $1,000. My dad was in charge of all the dynamiting. Every night after work, they dull the bars in the back of this home that we lived out of town. He had to sharpen them every day, and he did it always by hand, everything by hand, made the hole by hand, and so on. That's really why my dad got killed when he was working at what we call the lime quarry. What they did, got a lot of raw material by dynamiting and getting all that and transporting it. The ore was mined in Ruth. It was brought to the mill in McGill. There it was refined. It was sent to another place where it was actually melted. And what they would do with this material that my dad, they would take and truck it up and dump it along the sides. And occasionally they had bad luck where the heat was so intense it broke through. And in a situation like that, they had to just shut everything down to make the repair and so on. So that's what it was. But the day that he was in charge of all the charges, one didn't go off. Well, he waited, and then when he went to check, the damn thing went off. That's how my dad got killed.
When you find out that your father has died in this accident, and you know you've got a mother at home with 6 other kids to raise, and then you find out, hey, I'm heading overseas, was that hard? And did you wonder if you'd be coming back?
You know, that's something I don't know. I never thought about it. I knew I was going to go. You know, when I stop and think about that, probably I could have gone to the board and say, listen, I'm the oldest one in that family. I should be here to help my mother. That was something that never occurred to me. I was going to go, and that's the way it was.
And in combat, you flew P-51s.
Right.
What many would say is the greatest fighter plane that America had in World War II. If there's some P-47 pilots listening, I'm sure they're going to have a beef with you and have that argument with you. But you never flew it.
You don't have to tell me that, because one of the guys in prison with me was a P-47.
Oh, I'm sure you guys had plenty of time to talk about it.
He was with the 9th Air Force. They were ground support.
Uh-huh.
The P-47 had an air-cooled engine.
Right.
And the P-51 couldn't take the kind of hits that a P-47. The guy that I was in prison camp with, he told me there was many times he got banged pretty good, but he was always able to get back. And I can understand why they felt about that plane. But when it came to air combat, P-47, A-51, forget about it. They couldn't do it with a P-51.
They couldn't go as fast as you could. They didn't have the maneuverability that you had.
There were too many things that were bad.
But you never flew a P-51 until you were there in England.
That's
the very
right.
First time you flew it, it was a combat mission?
When we got to England, we went to a place called Gox Hill, and that was in the middle of England. And that's where all the Air Force personnel went. If a bomber needed replacements, that's where they got them from. If a fighter group needed replacements, that's where they got them from. I didn't know where I was going to go. There were four of us one day, and we ended up going with the 55th Fighter Group. And that's how we got to that group and so on. Okay, I'm getting ready to check out in a 51. So I went there, and the guy says, familiar yourself with all the instruments and so on. He put a blindfold on me, and he says, where's so-and-so? I point. Word so-and-so, I point. He says, okay, take it up. I took it out there. The moment that I hit that accelerator and what it did at the airplane that I could never feel with a B-40, man, whoom, you could just feel it was just different, speed-wise and all those things.
Was it like the difference between your speed and Marion Motley's speed?
I don't know. I don't want to tell you. That guy was unbelievable. I think about it because I know the number of times I got knocked on my tail trying to block a defensive end. But if he could get around that end, man, he was awful hard to stop.
So you started to tell me about the mission that proved to be your last.
Yeah.
Where instead of landing in France and being able to get back this time you're shot down over hostile territory. What happened? How did you get hit and how'd you go down?
We were supposed to strafe on the river.
The Rhine?
That goes basically north and a little bit to the west, and then it turns directly west and dumps into the English Channel. On this day, we were supposed to strafe on the Rhine, but it was really heavy cover. I mean, you couldn't see the ground. What would happen, we'd fly around, we'd find a hole, we'd dive down through the hole, and we did this eventually enough times, and we got down below the level. It must have been around 1,000, 1,200 feet. I don't remember. But we were around 600 feet or thereabouts. The guy that was leading us says, okay, get in flight formation. We're going home. I can remember distinctly to this day that when he said we were in friendly territory, let's go home, I thought, I remember Holland and a few of those places which were very close to where he was talking about. And I remember this Tudor 5-2, you sure we're in friendly territory? Yes. It wasn't maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, I get this jug. And I thought, what the hell's wrong? And pretty soon, I could see the tracers coming. We ended up going right over a flak battery. There were two other guys that went down. I didn't know what happened to them. They thought I got killed. They didn't know. Because once that happened, the planes just start scattering. Right away, when I got hit, and it start trying to go and try to. So I said, I got to get out of this plane. I can't. There's no way I can survive if I have to go into these dikes. There's no level ground around here. I got up to as much as I could to 1,000 feet, and I bailed out. And when I hit the ground, the parachute couldn't have been open very long because the moment I hit the ground, those knees came clear up beyond my face. And I think I was out of it for a while. It was windy, parachute was being drugged me, and I ended up in a ditch with water. And the moment I hit the water, I came to. But when I came to, I looked up on a bank, and here's a Sherman soldier pointing his gun at me, wanting me to get my hands up in the air. And that was it.
So because you had to bail out so low, the force with which you hit the ground sent your knees into your head and knocked you out.
It really, I don't remember being drug at all. Only thing I remember is the moment I hit that water, I came to. So I probably might have been out a little bit. I don't know.
And you were probably not too far from getting killed.
Well, there's a possibility.
I mean, you're probably a few seconds here or there, or
yeah.
The timing of it.
I don't know. It could have been very easily because I didn't hit like I thought. You know, we practiced with parachutes before we ever met on mission. I remember before I went to the group, we practiced. I mean, we had a place where we jumped off and opened the parachute and come down and get a feeling about what it was like and so on. But, you know, you never think that you're ever going to have to use a parachute. So.
And you probably never thought about being a prisoner before.
No, that never happened at all. I never thought that would happen.
So how did you deal with it when it was the reality staring you in the face?
I am going to tell you something. Gus Leslie was on a mission prior to when I went down. I remember when we get back, we talk about our mission, ask questions, and so on. But Gus wasn't in the same group that I was with. He was with a different one. The 343rd would go out, but you'd have four or five different flights in that particular one. I asked, where's Gus Leslie? Hey, where's Gus Leslie? No one knew. When I got shot down, the German soldier got me up in the air. They took me out into the middle of the, it was just an open area. I remember it was a little bit of rain. The head guy comes out. There's a couple of them standing there, and he's talking. I know that if I was in Japan, I wouldn't be here. That guy could have taken out a gun, bang. No one knew what happened to me. When I finally, eventually, when I tell you, when I got back to the group, talking to the guys and so on, they didn't know. They thought I had got killed and so on. Well, anyway, they put two soldiers with me, and eventually they're going to take me to an interrogation camp. And in interrogation, you're told, you don't have to give them anything but name, rank, and serial number. Then he starts asking you about other things. Where'd you go to school? All this stuff and so on. The guy that interrogated me, he knew so much more about the 8th Air Force than I'll ever know. But before I went to see the interrogator, the guy takes me out of this room. You're in a single room, and I'm walking. And as I'm walking, a door open on my right opens up. You know who it was? Gus Leslie.
What are the odds?
There are no odds. I don't know how you could. As I was walking right there, the door opened, and I said, Gus. And then I thought, God, that's terrible. You better not say anything. But he got away. I mean, he went down. He got shot down, and he was free for several days. And then looking for food and stuff, they finally got him. And then eventually they put him in the interrogation area. But when I stop and think, that day when I was walking, he was had a hold of me, taking me to the interrogator. Gus Leslie comes up. Then it wasn't very long after that they got rid of us and eventually they sent us to Stalag 1. We went by train.
Well, and you know, when you say you yell out his name and then you wish you hadn't, because they can use you against him and vice versa and try to get two to talk about each other.
Yeah.
But I imagine just seeing his face had to be at the time really significant for some hope to know that, hey, there's somebody I know that's going through this with me.
Yeah, they picked him up. I can say one thing. I had two German soldiers with me all the time. I went by train a number of times. This one particular time, they had an air raid. I had to get off the train and go into a nearby bunker. When I was down there, the whole place was loaded with German soldiers with head wounds. Everything up here and so on. There was a woman come over, and she's talking from about there to you, looking at her. And I don't want to even look at her. I'm trying to look away from her. And she must have called me every name under the sun, talking in German. You know, when I think about that, they could have killed me right there. Nobody would have known anything like that. Just like when I bailed out and the head guy came out and they were talking, what they were talking about, to have a couple of guys and go with me and take me to an interrogation place. But I didn't know that at the time.
And they needed those guys to protect you because the civilians might do something else with you.
They were with me all the time. That's what helped me the time that I'm telling you about when we got down there. And then, of course, the fact that I was a flyer and, you know, you're the enemy and that type of thing. And I was really glad because they stood one on each side of me when this gal was talking. And it didn't take long when it was over with. Boy, they got me out of there and so on. So from that standpoint, I was lucky that they were with me.
But 5.5 months of uncertainty were waiting for you as a prisoner of war. And we're going to hear about that with 93-year-old Turk Eliadis when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country, with 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 93-year-old Turk Eliadis of Bakersfield, California, originally from McGill, Nevada, but from November 1944 until the end of April of 45, a guest of the Gestapo, as they say, a prisoner of war in Germany. And when we left off, Turk, they were transporting you via an old 40-8 boxcar to Stalag Luft 1 in Barth on the Baltic.
They would not let us off the train. I mean, it got to the point where we needed water and people had to go to the John. They wouldn't let us get off the train because they were afraid if they did, we'd take off, you know.
So that's when you go in a helmet and pass it to the window or what?
The only thing I remember is I had to urinate and there was a place where you did. It was terrible. And we were there all the time until we got to Barth.
And you were probably pretty cramped in there,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah, we were cramped, and they just were scared that if they let us off, we'd take off, and I can understand how they feel, but it wasn't very good, and I don't remember how many hours it must have taken for that train to go from where we were interrogated to the camp itself.
And you're a 21-year-old kid, and you don't know how long this war is going to go. You don't know what it is like to be a prisoner, but now you end up in this prison camp where you... afraid? Did you have any expectation of what was going to happen?
No, I don't think so. I don't even remember being afraid of a situation. There were just a bunch of other people that were there. No one ever mentioned that there was something, they had done something that was, you know, beat somebody or something like that. It was unbelievable. It was just, I can't say that like I was on vacation somewhere. That's about what it was. But you know, we moved around in the compound. Some people set up a volleyball deal. They played volleyball. I played softball. We were allowed to pick a softball team from our compound. We went to the South compound and played the British in a softball game. And then I come to find out that there was a couple of guys in there from McGill, Nevada.
Wow.
They were on bombers and so on. We were in compound 3. They were in compound 1 or 2. I don't remember which one. But I had a chance to go and visit with them. If you signed up and you wanted to go visit, you could.
Well, speaking of McGill, what about your mom? Did she have any idea what had happened to you? Did she know where you were?
When she first heard, all she got was missing in action. Then, I don't remember whether it was several weeks or a month or so on, the Red Cross was giving names of people that were in prison. Then somebody there had contacted my mom that I was in prison camp. And that's when the first time that they knew I hadn't been killed, that I was in prison camp. They allowed us to write letters. I remember I wrote my parents, several times. And I remember writing Coach Bledsoe several times. And I remember when I got home, I remember Bledsoe gave me all that. He says, you want to see what you wrote? And so on. I don't know.
Did you ever have days in that camp? Because you're there until the end of April 1945. I mean, we're talking 5 months as a prisoner. Did you ever have days where you weren't sure if you were ever going to experience freedom again?
No. We had a makeshift radio that got news from London every night. We knew where Patton was. We knew where the British were. We knew that the Russians were coming from the opposite end. So it was just a matter of waiting until they got there. In all fairness, I never felt that when I was in prison camp that my life was in jeopardy. I never felt that way. I didn't talk about living, sleeping on straw mattresses and so on.
Give us, because most people have never and will never experience being a prisoner of war. especially in a German POW camp in World War II. What was that day-to-day like? I can't imagine it was very luxurious.
Well, the first thing we did, everybody had to get out in the compound, and they had to take a count. And sometimes they had trouble getting the correct count. Well, if you were an individual standing out there and you had to go to the bathroom and they kept waiting and kept, it got kind of bad. That was about the worst part that I could think of. We had to go out. Sometimes the count came up perfectly. Then there was a mad rush for the bathroom, you know, and so on.
And one of the reasons they do that is to see if anyone's escaped.
That's right.
Did you ever contemplate that, trying to escape?
No, never.
Ever have any of your buddies talk about it?
No. The people that got escaped, the cabins themselves, were right on the ground. So they were able to do that. With the compound that I was in, it was at least that high above the ground.
And they ran the dogs underneath it, probably,
You turn the dogs loose at night, and if you were stupid enough to try to escape, I don't think it would have been the smart thing.
What, I can't talk to an ex-prisoner of war without asking about the menu, the cuisine. What did you have to eat for those months there at Stalag Luft 1?
Okay, the main thing was bread. We had bread every day. Then we had kind of a stew where the meat was horse meat and so on. I know that with Butkereit, we were lucky because he could speak German. He would negotiate fresh eggs and stuff like that.
Wow.
But with the packages themselves, boy, they had coffee in there and they had powdered milk. You could mix it with water. Then towards the end, month or so, they quit coming. You know, you don't go around and ask, when are we going to get our parcels? You're in prison. Shut your mouth and just wait. You know, I didn't have much connection with the guards personally. One of the guys, like I told you, was named Butkereit. He could speak German, and he could speak to them. And I remember occasionally we would get a Red Cross parcel that had everything in there. The big bartering agent was cigarettes. I didn't care for cigarettes.
That made you a rich man, didn't it?
wait till I tell you. We got in a bridge game. Sam, the guy that flew the 47s, he and I were partners. And the way you got in, I think you put up two or three packages of cigarettes.
So when the Red Cross would send powdered milk and chocolate bars and all these other things, they'd also send you cigarettes.
That's right.
But you didn't smoke.
No, I didn't smoke at all. So you put up so many packages of cigarettes. And if you won all the cigarettes. Well, he and I got in this tournament, and we won the darn thing. And I can't tell you how many packages of cigarettes we had. We were rich. I mean, if you wanted something, up on the board, they say, okay, for three packages of cigarettes, we'll give you this. For so-and-so packages, we'll give you this. I guess we were in hog heaven. I don't know.
Now, there's a great story about the liberation of that camp because the Russians were coming, and instead of the Germans staying at the camp until the Russians got there, which was the plan, the ranking American, a fighter ace named Hub Zemke, negotiated with them to evacuate the camp. That's why when you guys woke up, you saw Americans in the towers instead of Germans in the towers.
Yeah.
I guess they didn't want to tell anybody ahead of time, but they had negotiated that with the Germans, and the thought was that's going to save a lot of lives.
Yeah, I think the Germans wanted to get the hell out of there.
They didn't want to deal with the Russians.
Oh, my. Yeah. The fear was terrible.
Did you know it was coming? Did you know that that Liberation Day was
approaching?
Oh,
yeah, we knew they were coming, but we didn't know exactly what day it would be.
Uh-huh.
But we knew the Russians were coming. The situation got so bad in town. German people came from the town, came to the prison, and asked for protection from the Russians.
Right. I have to imagine that there was a different atmosphere around the camp
in those few days.
Oh,
there's no doubt about it. You know, the Americans were up there. We could leave the camp. They said, maybe it'd be better if you just stay in camp. It'd be, you know, have no problem. I remember Gus and I and some others, we got out and walked around. What I was hoping, I could find some guy who was fishing, so I could borrow his pole. I wanted to fish and so on. I loved to fish and so on.
Did you lose any weight while you were there?
Yeah, lost weight. That's the only thing. I lost some weight.
How much?
Probably in the neighborhood of 15, 18 pounds, probably.
Not bad compared to some others I've heard.
I know some people, it was really a problem. I don't know why some people couldn't handle the food. I don't know why. I really loved the bread. I thought it was great. It was different.
With sawdust baked into it and all that?
Well, there's no doubt about it. When you cut a slice and you look at it, you have a feeling that there's some ingredients in there that you're not quite sure of.
But it kept you alive.
Oh, yeah. And like you say, you had straw mattresses. You hope some days where you get a sunny day where you could take it outside and shake it a little bit. Because once you slept in a certain position on that straw mattress, you had to get back in that same position to sleep. In other words, you can't sleep in a different part of that. I mean, you slept on your side, then you just fit into that part of the mattress and so on. But it was a prison camp.
So the camp's liberated, but you guys are still there. And I'm sure there's a little bit of, well, what's going to happen next? And then they fly some bombers in to pick
you
up?
They flew B-17s. It wasn't right away. It was a couple of weeks. Supposedly, can you imagine this? We had to get permission from the Russians to fly bombers in here. That's what they were telling us. But B-17s, then I don't remember how many we put on there, but I remember I was right up in front. We flew to Lucky Strike, which was in France, and then it was there that Leslie and I, we went somewhere and got on an airplane, flew back to the base, and went back to our outfit and visited with guys, you know, that we knew and everything else.
Did some of those guys still think you were dead?
Yeah, well, they didn't know that we were in prison. When I got back, there were several of the planes got shot down, and they thought I got killed. They didn't have any idea. You know, I have a feeling that what's happened, after I had communicated with the head guy and said, are you sure we are in friendly territory, I have a feeling that he might have called, somebody might have called back, called me, and I didn't answer. That's probably what happened.
So that would explain why they thought you were gone.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
But when they reported it to my mother, there's all they said, missing in action. That's all they said.
So when you actually got back to the States and got to go see your mother again,
yeah,
what was that like?
Well, Mom was beside herself. I remember we got to Salt Lake City. We went to one of the bases there. They gave us all our back pay and all that and so on. And then I took a bus from Salt Lake to McGill. We used to get the Salt Lake Tribune every day, and that bus run back and forth and bring the paper. But, of course, everyone was happy and all that. Now I'm sitting here talking with you. I look back on those days because now I think about those days and so on and what it was like. The things that happened to me before I ever got to the prison camp. Now that I think about it, if those two guards hadn't been with me, I don't know what would happen. Some German comes up and wham, you think they're going to make a big issue out of it if you're an American? Yeah, none at all.
And I'm thinking of everything that's happened for you in the last 70 years. I mean, you survive your engine quitting in this P-51 and having to bring it down in France. You survive getting shot down, being taken prisoner, 5 months in a POW camp, getting back home. You go back to school. You play college football again at the University of Nevada.
Yeah.
You become a coach, 32 years here at North High School. Some of your guys went on to play in the NFL. So many more are coaching and impacting other young lives.
Yeah.
You never would have met your wife at the University of Nevada. You wouldn't have your kids, your grandkids.
No, I met her after I got back from the service.
So, I mean, look at all those things that wouldn't have happened if those German guards weren't with you, if any number of these things. How do you explain all that?
The only thing that I can think of, and there are people that believe in that. My neighbor is very religious. You know, I've never been very strong in that area. I know that when I was a youngster, we went to church every Sunday, every Sunday. That was never a problem. And I remember when I knew that I was going to go, we had finished our training at Phoenix, Arizona. We were commissioned. Mom insisted that I go and have the Greek priest talk over me. I didn't go once. I went a couple times. Got to go. I'm not going to argue with Mom if that's what you want me to do. When my dad got killed, I told you the amount of time that I spent with Coach Bledsoe. When I came back from the service, I found out that Coach Bledsoe had left White Pine High School and taken a job at Shafter. When I finished at the University of Nevada, I went to USC to get my master's in education. And on Friday nights, I'd come up and watch the football games. It happened to be that the principal that was going to take North High School was the principal at Shafter. Dan says to me, he says, you know, you got a job here. Once you're finished down there, I coached the JVs. Dan had the varsity. The plans were Coach Bledsoe was going to come to North High School and be the head football coach and a counselor, as he was like Darren Shafter. Dan comes to me one day and he says, "You better apply for the North High job. My wife doesn't want to go to Bakersfield." And that's how I applied for the job. We opened the school in 1953, and I retired in 85. So I was there a few years.
And in many ways, I know you still are. And I'm sure we could go on for a long time, but I don't want to forget to say thank you.
Thank you
for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it. Is there anything that we didn't hit on that you think is important for people to know about World War II and the things you did, the guys you served with?
You know, when you're young and you're 21 years old, I think a lot of times you think you're indestructible, you know. Once I got over there and we were flying those missions and we were losing people. Every time we went on a mission and we did strafing and things like that, we were losing two or three people every day, you know. You know, I think back on, you know, being over there, the chances of getting killed, who knows?
Who knows? So many possibilities. What we do know is Turk has quite a story, and we're so glad he shared it here. There's a little more that he had to say that wouldn't quite fit into our radio time, but you will find it in the extended podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, encouraging you to remember, as Turk's prisoner of war story underscored again today, that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor. As I said, there was more to Turk's story than would fit in our radio time, so here's a listen to some more of the memories and thoughts he had to share.
I'm going to jump to something else here. When the war was over, there were members of the, we were the 343rd Squadron. There were three squadrons. And luckily, we had some guys that were in charge. And what they did, they tried to gather all the names that they could remember that was there and contacted us. And we had a reunion every year. 343rd had a reunion every year, once a year. We might be, oh my gosh, we went to Florida, we went to Louisiana, We went to, I'm not sure it was Illinois or Indiana. We went everywhere. And it was the greatest thing that happened for my wife and I, because we never came back. Most of the people would have the reunion for about 4 days, and everyone would go. We'd stay. We made a vacation out of it. If we were in this state, gee, we'd like to see that. Or we were hoping that we could get. We had been to a number of presidential libraries. The only one that I really feel bad about is we never got to New York, where I had a chance to go to, what was Franklin Roosevelt's in New York. We never did get one in the New York area, so I never had a chance to do that. But for my wife, it was vacation. And when I look back on that, it was one of the finest things that we ever did. Members of the other squadron start coming and going with us whenever we had it. But we were the only one that had a reunion after the war. People don't remember the Depression days in this country. 1928, 1929, 1930. I mean, things were bad. People weren't working. It was a tough deal. But Kennicott Copper did something that was important to them. They didn't lay my father off. They didn't lay anyone off. You could work 2 weeks, lay off 2 weeks. You had the ability to go get a commissary book against your dad's earnings, and you could go to that particular commissary and you could buy groceries that was there through the company. That was especially for that. Coach Bledsoe was my high school coach. When I played in high school, we didn't have free substitution. It isn't like today. You go in, you can play a few plays, you can come out, you can go back in if you want to. That period of time, let's say you came out on the second quarter. You couldn't go back in. Of course, you're going to go back at the end of the half anyway. But let's say you went out in the first quarter. You couldn't go back in the second quarter. You had to wait until halftime before you could go in. So I spent a lot of time with him as the quarterback, because we didn't have any system of running plays in or stuff like that. It depended on me to call the plays and everything. So I spent a lot of time with him, and I got very close with Coach Bledsoe. And I remember talking to the guys here, because the one fellow, he coached it. He was the head coach of the junior college team. And they played in that game, but I didn't know that. Only way I knew, if your name appeared in the paper, they in the fraternity, they always clipped it out and put it in a folder, they had all concerning fellas in the fraternity and so on. But when I got here and I start talking to him, and I says, I played against you when you played Nevada, and we got talking. And that's when I found out the head coach of the junior college also played in the same game.
What are the odds?
Now that I'm there, seeing the things that I've seen, the atrocities after the war, I say to myself, you were in a prison camp, but did you realize you'd ever see anything like that in your lifetime, like walking on that situation where he killed everyone in the family, for gosh sakes? And that night we went in town, Gus and I went in town, and they're bringing all the furniture out and putting in the middle of the street and putting everything on fire, chasing the gals all over the place. I stop and think, you realize you'd had to be in war to have a situation like that and be there when the enemy's coming back and they're going to take out their half or whatever. I don't know.
And when you say they put you on these trains, this is not Amtrak. We're talking about the old 40 and 8s, 40 men or 8 horses.
Oh, yeah. They would not let us off the train. I mean, it got to the point where we needed water and people had to go to the John. They wouldn't let us get off the train because they were afraid if they did, we'd take off,
Well, I'm thinking there's probably a lot of those moments.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Another one for a lot of guys that they feel something that perhaps saved their life was Truman's decision to use atomic weapons.
Oh, yeah.
Brought the war to a close, and you would have been going over to fly.
Oh, yeah, we were there being ready to be reassigned.
So maybe it saved your life, but I understand that the testing in Eastern Nevada in the nuclear program ended up costing a couple of your siblings their lives.
Lost practically everyone in the family.
From radiation sickness?
There's a small place outside of Las Vegas, and they were using atomic bombs. They were setting them off above the ground. They weren't the big ones. They were smaller ones. And they did not realize, you see, whenever we used to see pictures about this, they never realized the ill effects of atomic bomb. Is all they were concerned about, how much could it destroy?
Right.
That's what their concern was. And then I remember vividly when the sheep people in Utah got up one morning to go out and check the sheep. They're all dead, and so on. Then they start investigating the problem. And that was the problem that happened because the prevailing wind went right through White Pine County, went right through McGill. Both sisters died of cancer. Both brothers died of cancer. Everyone died of cancer. One thing the government did, they wouldn't admit that that was the cause of them dying. But once they realized, and there was more people complaining and more things happening because of all that, then they realized that they were at fault. Darn, what is the term that I should use? The offspring of the atomic bomb?
Radiation?
The radiation. In other words, the radiation which killed all those sheep.
Yeah.
The radiation, in other words, they didn't feel it right there, but they got enough of it that my both sisters died of breast cancer. Jim died of, what did he have? It was a blood situation. And then Sam, he thought he had beat it, and so on. And then eventually he died also.
And was that testing during the war or after the war?
That was testing after
right
the
after.
War.
Yeah.
That was after the war when yeah. they were doing this. Mm-hmm. And they weren't using the big ones, obviously. They yeah. were using a smaller one. But there again, you still had the same problem. And I don't know. It's my mother lived through all of that. I can't believe that. My mother died. She was 95 years old. And she lived through all of that. And it was just, but with my sisters and my brothers, my youngest brother wasn't involved. But the two older brothers and the two daughters both died of breast cancer. In the service, you didn't worry about weather. I never knew we were going to go on a mission when I was at the base. You know why? It was ground fog. It was thick. We went up and flew into the... We took off. You think we didn't go? We did. I never thought about that. We're going to go. And the way you did, you'd have one guy here and you'd follow him. Mm-hmm. And if he didn't do well going up through that fog, you were in trouble because you were following him. You weren't going on your own.
Right.
But thank God the fog was maybe, what, 600, 700, maybe 1,000 feet. It was just a matter of moments. The moment you got up in that fog, you were gone. The thing that you were concerned about, the main, if there was fog when you came back, then that would really create a problem. That would really create a problem if you had ground fog. We never had that problem. Whenever we had to come back, if it was really overcast and so on, you kind of drove around and you found a hole, you kept diving, and eventually you'd get down. That wasn't a problem. And you could call the base and they would give you a bearing and everything else. You know, when you're coaching football, people don't realize that is completely different than coaching baseball, basketball, you name it. You're with those kids and you have them for 8 or 9 weeks and so on, it's just like they're a part of you. Mm-hmm. You're out there with them every day. And then you're lucky enough that some of them are good enough to go to a major school and get themselves an education. And I used to really jump even the ones that knew that they weren't going to be able to do it. I said, you go to the junior college, play for them. The junior college here has a great reputation. There's many schools coming here looking for football players. I said, you have a chance. Don't worry if you don't go to Stanford or Cal or someplace like that. If you just go to a school where you can get your education, and that's the main thing. And you kept pounding on stuff like that. And it was important as a coach that you do that. But, once a year, we have a group of former football players. One of them has a cabin up there at June Lake, and we go there for a fishing expedition for a few days. That's interesting. The one guy never fished in his life, and it ended up he caught more fish than anyone.
Go figure.
But I don't know. Yeah. You have a strong feeling. I tell you, if you're a coach, and I was lucky that I'm able to meet with those kids. I call them kids. They're not kids anymore, but they are to me. And, just like there's a book in there now that one of them insists that I read has to do with the University of Washington and the people that did the rowing up there.
Oh, yeah.
And so on. It's a big deal and so on. I never got to that book. I have a real good friend that I played football with, University of Nevada. He was a quarterback. And I'm in touch with him, and we've gone places with him and everything else. And he has given me a book, and I haven't read it all yet. I just can't believe what I'm reading in that book. Anyway, he ran for, I don't remember the office that he ran for the state of Nevada, and he was elected. And he spent a lot of time in Las Vegas. This book is all about that. Mm. The situation there was unbelievable. The things that they did there in those years and so on. And he met a lot of those people and so on. He says, you got to read this book and so on. And the more I read, I wondered how all that got on. The money that was moved from there elsewhere. In those, it was something. I don't know whether it's the same situation now or not. If it is, it's really on the. It's not by anyone knowing about it. But
wouldn't shock me.
When money's involved, anything can happen. I don't care. But I don't know. It's been great for me.